I was reading this article in Variety, and it was talking about technical categories, because those are the nominations for those, I think, are easier to predict, right? Like,
usually, yeah.
Yeah, the big budget films are going to end up in like best CGI, best costume design, all that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah. And they have like these guilds too. Like, yeah. The guilds do all of their awards leading up to the Oscars. And so oftentimes, whoever wins best editing for the guild, that they tend to win the best editing Oscar.
Yeah. So in a few instances in the past, even the recent past, and I'm thinking like Mad Max here, where like a really good film will clean up the technical categories, but they don't win Best Picture. And every time, ever since Best Picture became a 10 nominee category, what's happening now is that a lot of these films that, you know, maybe aren't Oscar bait, but really excel in the technical categories, end up getting a Best Picture nomination. So in this case, Top Gun Maverick is actually predicted to get nominated for Best Picture because so many of the technical aspects are just so well done. And so the logic is, if you do well in the technical categories, then by definition, it's actually a well-made film, and a well-made film should be nominated for Best Picture.
Yeah, I would agree with that methodology. And I mean, they would also, just when it comes to Top Gun Maverick specifically, they would be crazy not to nominate it, because I remember when it came out and like maybe 2 months had gone by, most other movies would have left theaters by that point. But yeah. Top Gun Maverick was still bringing people in. And if you were just out in general conversation with people who are not movie buffs and you asked them, hey, have you seen a movie in theaters recently? Guaranteed they would have said that they saw Top Gun Maverick. And it showed in the box office receipts, because it went on to be like top 10 of all time.
And it was one of those films where like hardcore movie critics and fans really agreed that it was just a really well done film.
The Academy themselves would be nuts not to nominate it, because they are constantly facing this problem of like, how do we nominate movies that real people have seen, so that when they watch the show every year, they don't feel like it's a bunch of pretentious crap and none of the movies that they've actually seen, you know.
Yeah.
That's why they always get bad press when not enough superhero stuff gets nominated, because, you know, for better or worse, that's what people are seeing, and they don't see it reflected in the stuff that wins the prizes.
Yeah. And if you're talking about movies in general, like, how can the Academy turn its back on Top Gun, the movie that I think really saved a lot of their big tentpole films and a lot, and like a big part of their industry?
Yeah.
And it also proved that, you know, people really don't always have an appetite for superhero films. You can make a film that's just good guys versus bad guys about some, you know, real life event or real life organization, and you don't need the freaking shared multiverse to do it.
Yeah, it can just be like a one-off thing, and maybe it'll get a sequel, maybe not.
I hope we don't get a sequel, but going back to the Best Picture thing, that is why Wakanda Forever, Black Panther 2, is also predicted to get a Best Picture nomination, even though I don't think it deserves to be there, but just no. Because technically it's so well done in terms of like the costumes, I was going to say CGI, but it's not very good CGI, but just a lot of the other stuff, the editing, the sound, everything, all that combined will lead it to get a Best Picture nomination.
Yeah. Well, we will definitely talk in more depth later in the episode about where we think the races are headed, specifically Best Picture, because it'll, you know, as always, there's an interesting conversation around what is actually a front runner and what is just there to, you know, make the telecast more interesting. But without any further ado, should we get into the intro?
Yes.
Welcome to the Extra Buttery Podcast. It's a show about movies, TV, anything with a story and actors on a screen, really. Join Jason Chan and Robert Snow's free-flowing conversation with deep dives into characters and plot with the occasional salty opinion. So get your popcorn. I got mine right here. Let's start the show!
And welcome to episode 115 of the Extra Buttery Podcast. My name is Robert Snow in Toronto, and I'm joined by my co-host, Jason Chen, in Vancouver.
Hello.
And this episode, it's our first of 2023, and we haven't done an episode in a little bit, and we thought, hey, why don't we just catch up a little bit on some of the end-of-year stuff that we were watching over the holiday break. You know, Jason and I go off, and we often spend a bit of time over the holidays catching up with all the things that we're told are going to be important for the Oscars and all the other stuff that we might have missed along the way. So that's what we're going to be recapping in this episode for you. We're going to be talking about such highlights and lowlights as The Whale, Babylon, Avatar, The Way of Water, Glass Onion, A Knives Out Mystery, and many, many more. So keep your dial tuned. No, that doesn't work with podcasts. Don't click away. Don't click away.
Well, see, I wish we had a say in what the Oscars and all these awards, big awards, nominate, because they make some really bizarre decisions. And I think this is one of those years where it's really tough to tell, because I don't feel like there's one standout film. Do you feel that way?
Yeah, it feels a little more crowded. What role do you think the streamers are going to play this year? Like, what do you think they're going to put forward as their big swings? Because previous years, you had Netflix coming up with like really art house stuff, like Alfonso Cuarón, or you know, with Roma, and they're really trying to be, you know, the one to get Best Picture as a streaming service and not a traditional movie studio. Last year, it went to a streamer. It went to Apple for whatever that Best Picture winner was that I didn't see, because it's on Apple. which I'm sure is a great film. But anyway, but Netflix is yet to get a Best Picture award. So it has Amazon. So I'm sure they're hungry for it. They want the prestige that comes along with it. Do you think for Netflix, it might be Glass Onion?
No. I don't think it's one of the better films. If anything...
But do you think it'll be nominated, though? I don't think it'll win, but do you think it'll be
for
nominated?
For Best Picture? No.
Yeah.
For Netflix, okay. I think it's All Quiet on the Western Front. I think that's their best picture.
But that doesn't have the kind of popular buzz behind it.
No, but it's a war film, and Hollywood loves war films, and it's very anti-war, which, again, they love. But I think from a technical standpoint, from my own consumer's view, I enjoyed it a lot more than Glass Onion. I think this new version of All Quiet on the Western Front, although I haven't seen the old one in many, many years, I still think the old one's superior. I have certain gripes about this new one that just came out, but it's a really well done film. I don't think Netflix or Amazon will have a win. Although, wasn't that Mexican picture from Netflix, Roma? Didn't that win?
It won, yeah. Or, well, it got close, but I think it won for director and not picture.
Okay. Because that was Netflix one, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's probably as close as they've come. I don't see All Quiet on the Western Front winning anything, to be honest. I just think it's a very solid film. And Amazon Studios, it's hard for me to tell what their big release is. I did see 13 Lives, which is about the story about the soccer team trapped in the cave in Thailand. But other than that, I don't think they have anything else. Maybe Argentina in 1985. I've yet to see that one. But they tend to do more international stuff. But there's no big push. I don't know. What do you think? You think Netflix and Amazon have a chance this year?
It doesn't really feel like it. I can't think of a movie off the top of my head that seems to have a lot of energy behind it. In the way that some of their previous years were. But in terms of like. Other movies that may be getting the nod, that may be more of a front runner, Fablemans. I know you have your very warranted misgivings about Steven Spielberg's recent output, but it has that crowd pleaser quality and that kind of ode to the movies that Hollywood loves. And, you know, we have to remember that the Oscars is voted on by a group of people who work in Hollywood. So they're going to be suckers for a story about the movies.
Yeah. So, it is interesting to me, two things. One, that it's taken Spielberg this long to do sort of a semi-autobiographical pick about himself. Mm-hmm. A lot of directors have at least made some ode to film or their childhood. I think Kenneth Branagh is really guilty of this. And the other thing is, I've heard that the Fablemans is really losing steam in that everyone knows it's Oscar bait and the voters are conscious of not voting for Oscar bait.
Yeah. And it's been out for a while, so it's fading from memory a little bit. It didn't have that holiday push that some other titles had. And yeah, you do have other filmmakers who are competing for that kind of self-reflecting type of title this year. Sam Mendes has Empire of Light, which I saw at TIFF. It wasn't fantastic.
It's getting no buzz.
But it's another example of like something about the movies, about a guy reflecting on his childhood or his teen years. So that's in the that may get a nod here or there. Maybe Olivia Colman for actress. I don't know. And then not to be outdone, Alejandro Iñárritu has got another Netflix project himself that is apparently very art house and unlikely to even pick up any nominations. It sounds like a bad time all around, just very very navel gazy.
Is that out yet?
I don't even know. I think maybe it came out, but again, zero buzz. So people aren't really going for the director self-reflexive stuff in the way that you might think.
I think other than Top Gun for Paramount and Avatar for 20th, I think this is a year where like one of the smaller studios might win, like Sony Pictures Classics or Netflix or A24. A24 is having a huge year. Fox Searchlight. I think it's going to be really tough to name a winner. Like if I had to make you pick right now, who do you think would win Best Picture? Not who you want, but who you think.
Honestly, I think this might sound crazy. It might be Top Gun.
Interesting. So
because you've got the combination there of, you know, everyone agreeing that it had a role in kind of bringing people back to the movies. It has universal acclaim across regular audiences, and it's got all the craft stuff, the technical stuff that makes the industry insiders want to root for it. So it's got a lot going for it. I mean, is it too popular to win Best Picture? I don't know.
I think I'm more cynical. I don't think Top Gun's going to win Best Picture, because I still think that there's a lot of hesitation in awarding like the big summer blockbuster films Best Picture.
Yeah.
I actually think the Best Picture winner will be Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Oh, yeah. That's possible.
I think of all like the smaller budget, granted, this is $25 million, so it's not like... Even for indie film, it's like a pretty good budget.
Yeah.
As far as all the small budget films goes, that's getting all the buzz. This one seems to have captured both critics and audiences. So I feel like Everything Everywhere All at Once is probably a fair compromise for the Academy. I think it's the safer choice for
them.
Yeah. I think naming Top Gun Best Picture would be awesome. And I think it would be a watershed moment for Hollywood. But I don't think they're ready for it yet.
Well, we still have a few months to go before that gets the conversation gets really heated up anyway. But should we drill into a few more of the 2022 things that we haven't talked about in detail? We did bring up Glass Onion just then as a thing that Netflix would probably love to pick up some nominations for. But being the fact that it's a sequel and they didn't have much of a theatrical push behind it, I don't know if his chances are that high.
It's been a murder. And the killer is in plain sight. For at least one person, this is not a game.
I liked it a lot. I know you, we already sort of corresponded about how you didn't engage with it, but I'm a sucker for the old school, like, drawing room mystery, like the Hercule Poirot style of, like, you know, throwing a bunch of red herrings at the audience and then giving a big, long, expositional monologue at the end. Somehow,
and also a sucker for Rian Johnson.
Well, yes, yeah, that's well established too. But I mean, the guy knows his way around this format. It's just it works for me. I love the ensemble casts. I just I had a great time.
I think what Rian Johnson really excels in is subversion. So mystery is like right up his alley, right? So if you look at his Star Wars entry, it is completely all subversion. And it doesn't necessarily work because there's so much canon, but in this Knives Out universe, and I heard he doesn't even like having the Knives Out subtitle in there. That's purely for marketing.
Yeah.
I think murder mysteries are right up his alley. I think for me personally, it runs the danger of, as a viewer, not paying any attention to anything that's going on the screen because everything turns out to be a lie.
That's fair. I mean, you are kind of treading a little bit towards Ben Shapiro territory by
but I
understand it. I mean, it can be frustrating depending on how the filmmaker and the screenwriter mm-hmm. handle it. You know, how do they keep the audience in on the mystery, make them feel like they are uncovering the clues at the same time as the detective, but how do you still surprise them?
So I liked Knives Out better because I think the ensemble cast was better. I like the story a lot better. Mm. I do think Janelle Monáe is incredible. I remember seeing her in Moonlight and she had a small role and I thought she was excellent. And then she did that horror movie about slavery. I can't remember the name right now.
That was an Amazon one, I think.
Yeah, okay. I can't remember the name, but you know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, doesn't she play someone who gets seemingly pulled back in time?
Exactly. Yeah. It's a one-word movie. I can't remember. But anyway, she's fantastic. Her music is great, too, by the way. But yeah, we're seeing like a big structure sort of like come out of these Knives Out movies. And I would be surprised if we ever strayed from that. And it's to have a mystery, part of the reveal, midway through the movie, and then a subversion, and then Benoit Blanc does his own thing. I didn't find the statement as compelling. I'm tired of villains who are supposed to be satires of techno bros. I think Edward Norton was too obvious to be like the culprit or the criminal, I guess. Something about Edward Norton, I think I've seen close to 90% of all of Edward Norton's works.
Whoa.
And he's never played like a straight good guy. And when he does, it's not good.
Yeah. But okay, so on the topic of satirizing tech bros, because that the movie obviously hinges on that idea, there's been plenty of recent depictions of tech bros of different ages in things like Don't Look Up. And
that was the worst one.
But do you think that the depiction of the kind of tech bro as a secret idiot who just coasts on the innovations of others, do you think that was better handled in this than other ones, or do you think this one was just as annoying as all the others?
I think it was just as annoying
because I thought it was a little bit more subtle. I thought it was definitely.
And I love the part about how he makes up words or uses like the wrong word to describe something.
Yeah,
like
malapropisms, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And that was kind of the first thing that caught me off guard was the way he talks. But once you catch on to that, then the mystery doesn't become as much of a mystery. I think you keep wanting to see the reveal. And then when it's revealed that Janelle Monáe has a twin, then you're kind of like, well, okay, this is just like one of those like dime a dozen, you know, there's a secret twin type of movies. And I thought back to The Prestige where Christian Bale pulls double duty. And I thought that reveal was way better than what they did in Glass Onion. As a metaphor, as a satire, I didn't find it as compelling as Knives Out. In Knives Out, you had institutional wealth. So like wealth is passed down. And in this one, you have creation of wealth that is refused to be shared. And I thought that was kind of interesting. But I feel like the previous statement was a bit more clear and concise.
I mean, that's fair. Like it's, I think one of the, they're planning to make at least three more of these. And I think, you know, Rian Johnson is going to have to alternate a little bit as he goes. But in choosing the types of wealth that he satirizes, you know, maybe go back and forth between institutional and new wealth and
the structure of the film itself too.
Yeah. I mean, but the structure is very similar to like an Agatha Christie style mystery where there is a huge unraveling at the end where suddenly a whole bunch of facts that we were never party to are brought to light because the detective is just that good. And then the question is, I think, you know, where Rian Johnson's screenwriting comes in is how he times those reveals. So in the case of like the old school Agatha Christie stuff, it all comes at the end. In the case of the Knives Out films, usually there's a few more info dumps earlier on in the film.
Yeah.
They're designed to trip you up. And, you know, the probably the most memorable one in Glass Onion is how you think there's going to be this murder mystery game being played out at this fancy resort where they all are and the lights go out. But then Benoit Blanc solves the thing that Edward Norton's character has devised within like 90 seconds. So it's you think it's going to go one way, and then there's already a bit of a fork in the road. Or very early on.
If he's going to make an entire series out of these, I hope he kind of changes up the structure a little bit.
Mm, yeah.
I thought the biggest misstep in this one is Benoit Blanc inserting himself into this murder mystery that he was not invited to. I think it would be more compelling if Edward Norton's character purposely invites Benoit Blanc to the dinner party.
Right.
And just as a test of his mettle, kind of like how Moriarty used to set up these elaborate mysteries for Sherlock to solve.
Right.
But I get Benoit Blanc is a different character. It's a whole different universe. My question to you, though, is does Daniel Craig ever get a Best Actor nomination for Benoit Blanc? Or is it too bizarre, too much of a caricature, too much of sort of like a stock character to be nominated?
I mean, he's clearly having a lot of fun with it.
Yeah, he's one of the best parts about these mysteries.
And there's been a lot of fun stuff on Twitter recently with people writing up tweets in the style of Benoit Blanc's monologues, which I've been trying my best to read out in the voice of Benoit Blanc, and I don't know if I'm doing a good job, but...
No, you promised me an impression.
I did promise you an impression. Let me find one real quick. Benoit Blanc in Jurassic Park. So what you're telling me is that this confounding mosquito is of an utmost importance in the untangling and producing of this here dino DNA? Sweet beans, life does have a way of, well, finding a way.
All right, not bad. Not bad. I'll give you that one.
Yeah. So there's been, and then there was another bunch of people who were complaining that no one was getting the writing correct, and that Rian Johnson's the only person who can make Benoit Blanc sound convincing. But suffice it to say, like, to answer your original question, like, does he get a nomination? Not for this iteration, I don't think. But you know how the Oscars can kind of like, it can kind of let a series go on for a while, and then it almost wants to give out awards for the final installment as a sense of like, ooh, you've been playing these characters for a while, or you've done this whole series, we're going to give you an award at the very end. So who knows? Maybe for the fifth one, they'll start dishing out.
They should have done that for Viggo Mortensen.
Exactly.
As Aragorn. He deserved a lot of props, and he got none. Absolutely none.
I guess the Return of the King got 11 other Oscars that year, so they...
All right, but I mean, it's the performance.
I know,
Not the film, so... Anyway, I don't have Glass Onion in as much of a player in the awards categories, maybe for screenplay, maybe editing, but other than that, I don't see it being a big entry.
No, it might just be kind of like a less productive year for Netflix on that front. Should we talk Avatar then? While we're talking other 2022 big budget stuff?
They did pay a lot for Glass Onion.
They paid a lot for Glass Onion, and that was just for like developing like the five films. But that still doesn't really hold a candle to what good old Jim Cameron is dishing out for his five Avatar films.
We cannot let you bring your war here.
Outcast. That's all they see.
I see you.
He famously or infamously said a few weeks ago that in order for Avatar Way of Water to break even, it had to become the fifth or sixth highest grossing film of all time.
Could happen.
He's since revised that down a little bit. He made it sound like 1.5 billion was enough. And that's, you know, it's reached the level that he's comfortable with, and he's going to go ahead with number three.
Well, even if it was losing money, I don't see how you can't go for number three.
He's already done so much production on it. It's almost like
Well, it's also just good buzz. Like, I was kind of disappointed by the story, but not surprised. But the technical aspects are incredible. Like, the water CGI, there are a couple scenes where the HFR does get distracting, like in the first movie. I don't think you could get away from that. I think it's just the way our eyes are trained.
I tried my best to trust him going in, you know, I had my misgivings about whether or not to see it in HFR, high frame rate. And for a bit, I was like, oh, I'm just going to go with a regular 24 FPS, like normal projection. And then I was like, no, I'll make Jim Cameron proud. I'm going to see it the way he intended. And I did, and I didn't like it. And I've,
oh, you didn't like it.
I didn't like it. And I have basically decided that, I don't know, he's going to have to really push the envelope with the next ones, change around how he's doing it. Cause for me,
well, it's going to be Fire, eh?
Well, I suppose, but like Fire doesn't even,
yeah, here he said it.
Oh, no, I know, but Fire's not going to look particularly better in HFR than the water stuff.
No.
So
no,
I just find it more distracting when it's switching back and forth between the high frame rate and the normal frame rate.
It is kind of distracting. And yes.
I don't see the advantage that the higher frame rate brings to those action scenes. It just,
I agree. It's too video gamey.
It's way too video gamey, and I don't know what it will take to make that style of filmmaking work. But you're right. Setting aside high frame rate, like technical achievements all over the place. Like, you know, there'll be VFX companies studying this film for years to come. But I couldn't help but think to myself as the screening ended, I was like, wow, I finally made it through, you know?
Really? You couldn't wait for the end? I thought that it didn't feel like 3 hours. Well, there was an hour of like exposition of exploring this new world. And like, that's when you kind of let the story go and you kind of, you know, wash yourself with the technical aspects, which I thought were really well done.
I suppose.
But I agree with you.
I mean,
it's, if you're not into the technical stuff, the story does not warrant a 3 hour story.
Well, that's the problem, right? Like I'm as into the tech stuff as anyone. Like I know more about the behind the scenes making of it than your average person coming in off the street. But for me, that's still not enough to sustain like a full hour interspersed, like chopped up amongst all the other bits of just like these adoring shots of like the characters swimming through the water and hanging out with fish and all that. Like, I mean, I'm happy to get that as like a bonus scene on a Blu-ray, not in, you know, not making my stay in the theater any longer.
You know what it almost became though? It almost became a film that you see in Science World, like a wildlife National Geographic David Attenborough film.
Yeah. And so credit to the, like the production designers for coming up with all of the wildlife and the flora and stuff to like fill up that world and make it feel like another planet. All of that's cool. But I think I would rather be walking through that at like in like an aquarium type experience rather than being chained to a seat for 3 hours.
So why'd you give it 4? 4 is a pretty high score.
That's just a product of like the technical achievement, I think.
I took at least 1 star off for the story because it's just not very interesting. The technical stuff is amazing. I saw I was like you. I was considering watching it in like a regular screen, but I went for the 3D HFR. And I was impressed. It did seem like it wasn't. Video games are so good these days. I don't know if you played this game. It's called Horizon Forbidden West.
I haven't played it, but I'm familiar with it.
Okay, so the cutscenes in that, in my opinion, are really top notch. Avatar obviously takes it to the next level, but to me, both of them are cut from the same cloth. They're video game cutscenes that are just really, really well generated by the CGI. Other than that, I think the story is bare bones. We got stock characters. We got little character development. It was a lot of cliches. I got kind of tired of watching Tarzan bound around. I didn't think Stephen Lang's character made any sense at all from beginning to end.
I had a problem with that too, because, you know, if James Cameron is really a confident filmmaker, he would trust himself to come up with a new villain.
Yeah.
You know, like not just come up with some hand wavy crap about, oh, we cloned him and put him in a Navi body and he's just the same guy as before.
And then he survives the final fight. Like, come on, dude.
Well, I think Cameron said years ago, back when, you know, they were mired in production on this thing and they were delaying it for the umpteenth time. He said that he wanted Stephen Lang to be the ultimate villain of the whole series. So when he said that before the second one came out, I was like, oh, so Quaritch is going to keep coming back. He's going to be, if he's not outright killed in an installment, he'll be cloned and, you know, drop back in again. So why would I be invested in Quaritch as a character, as a villain, you know, if I know that he's going to survive to the fifth one.
Same with Sully's character. When they introduced that many kids, I knew one of them was going to die.
Yeah.
I thought the most interesting character was, though, teenage Sigourney Weaver. I thought that was quite the achievement in terms of acting and CGI.
Her voice didn't really get into the right register, though. It still sounded like like Sigourney Weaver at her current age, but in a younger body. But, you know, that's a quibble. But, I would say that character is definitely key to understanding the overall, like, spirituality of that series. Like, it's something that matters very deeply to James Cameron. He's thought a lot about how the whole, like, interconnectedness of that planet works. And I'm sure there'll be some revelation in, like, the fourth movie where, you know, that character becomes, like, a god or something.
Yeah, for sure. So it's hinted that she is basically the offspring of the life energy that they have or whatever.
Yeah.
Because there's no dad, right? It's like the Immaculate Conception and all that stuff. So I imagine there's some sort of like big sacrifice that she's going to end up having to make. But interesting that you mentioned the spirituality of it. If you take away the spirituality of it, if you just don't buy into this world, this Pandora world, the script is awful.
It is. Yeah.
And some of the ideas are just laughably bizarre, funny, and awkward. There are a couple times if I wasn't enamored with what was going on the screen that I would have just laughed out loud. When they were talking to the whales, like that just almost cracked me right up. And it's like this whale lets out like one call and it's a full sentence. And I'm like, what? How do you?
They're such complex creatures.
I know. How do you get a full sentence from this one call? The pitch was the same. It didn't seem like there was many syllables, but okay, I'll go with it. And that's most of the movie. But the fact that I was willing to go for it for 3 hours, I think is a credit to James Cameron.
So do you think they're going to come up with some other fantasy resource for them to exploit for the Fire Tribe?
Listen, it's going to be The Last Airbender. The first one was forest. The second one was water. Third one's fire. One of them's going to be wind. One of them's going to be earth. One of them's going to be metal or some... You know, stupid shit like that. Like, I give Jim Cameron 0 points for originality, but like 1,000 points for being this technical genius. And that's why I will not win Best Picture, by the way.
Oh, yeah. No, I didn't really ever consider this as Best Picture. I know that
it's going to get nominated.
It'll get nominated because it's a big movie and it made a lot of money. But similar to 2009 with Hurt Locker winning, like, you know, I think sometimes the Academy can be a little bit petty about. You know, and this is where the Top Gun conversation starts up again, right? Like, does a movie get to win purely because of how popular it is and how much money it's made, or do they just reflexively hand it to a small indie drama because that's the more artistic or creative thing to do? Yeah. I don't know.
I loved The Hurt Locker first time I saw it, but then the second time it was no good. The tension was all gone, and it is just. Is a very narrow focused, somewhat boring war movie.
Mm. While we're talking about little indie dramas, do you want to fill us in on The Whale? I haven't seen it yet, but
okay.
I know that, you know, this is going to be the front runner for best actor for sure.
Right off the bat, I'm going to say I disagree with that. Having watched it, I think Brendan Fraser's performance was a clear indicator that he could act. But it sprawled off in so many different directions. It almost felt like he was playing two or three different characters at once. It was a bit of a mess, to be honest. But it was kind of beautiful to watch, but also hard to watch because he plays this morbidly obese character who is killing himself slowly.
So the question though is that, like you disagree with him getting best actor for it, but do you think the Academy will?
I don't think the Academy will give it to him. I think he'll get a nomination because I think it was a very difficult role. And anytime you get fat and ugly, the Academy loves it.
Yes.
Although this movie sparked a lot of debate about the depiction of obese people in movies, which honestly, I don't honestly give a fuck about because everyone's entitled to their own opinion and he's not supposed to be like a likable character. So everyone has their own opinions about how we depict people of, you know, minorities and handicaps and all sorts of stuff. And I think a lot of it's unwarranted, but anyway, The Whale, A24 film directed by Darren Aronofsky. I actually had forgotten that it was directed by Darren Aronofsky. So
yeah,
I walked in and I was like, okay, this is going to be like, you know, a drama, and then I saw Aronofsky's name on the screen. I was like, oh shit. Mm-hmm. I'm in for some dark shit, man. And it was. It was very dark. It's based on a play of the same name, adapted into a film. Brendan Fraser plays this morbidly obese guy who's trying to reconnect with his estranged daughter who he left when she was 8 years old. It, much like a play, there's only one setting. It's his apartment. He's morbidly obese, so he can't go anywhere. I have to say it was a tough watch. Aronofsky's films are always a tough watch, but I found this particularly tough because, again, it's like Requiem for a Dream. It's I didn't find any of the characters particularly redeeming, except for one, and that's Hong Chau. She plays the nurse.
Oh, yeah.
She, at some point, she needs to get an Oscar nomination because she's that good in this movie. I think she outshines Brendan Fraser. But the story wasn't compelling. There wasn't a lot to uncover regarding Brendan Fraser's condition or the underlying plot and some of the motivations behind the characters. In fact, I found it maybe because it was the constraints of the play, but I definitely found they lacked a lot of development. And a lot of questions were asked that went unanswered. And I walked out of the movie feeling somewhat unsatisfied. I found it hard to root for Brendan Fraser's character, even though you're supposed to. And it left a bit of a sick feeling in my stomach because it ventures on like torture porn at certain points where you see Brendan Fraser go through this like bout of depression or emotional, you know, low, and he just eats himself into death, basically. And it's just kind of hard to watch.
Right.
I don't know if I'd recommend it. I'd be interested to see what you thought of it. But I don't think this is going to get Best Picture or Best Acting. It'll probably get nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay, but I don't think it'll win either.
Yeah, it's had a fair share of criticism. I know that from just scrolling on Twitter, and you know, people are divided about it because, yeah, you anytime you depict a disability, there's going to be some very passionate critiques of how it's done. But yeah, it is a test for that, you know, ever present rule of like, you know, you degrade yourself as an actor, you pile on the makeup, you pile on the weight or whatever to play a character. Does that get you in the running automatically? You know, do people think critically about what the movie's actually saying, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
And the movie like tries to say certain things about, you know, poverty, you know, depression, homosexuality, being sort of like on the edges of society and being ignored or not loved. But I felt like so many films have done the same thing, but better.
Well, should we talk a little bit about another Hong Chau appearance in The Menu?
Sure. Did you watch this?
I did, yeah.
What happens inside this room is meaningless compared to what happens outside. We are but a frightened nanosecond. Yes, sir! Nature is timeless. Yes,
sir! What the hell is going on?
I love you all.
We love you too, sir!
I remember it was on my short list, I think, for TIFF, but just didn't get around to fitting it into the schedule. And then it came out, when was it, November? And checked it out. And I kind of liked it. I mean, I appreciated a lot of what it was doing with the kind of the critique that it was lodging against the world of haute cuisine.
The key word is you kind of liked it.
Yeah, because it's not.
And I was the same. I didn't love it. I thought it was too cliched. I thought it was too predictable. And I thought in terms of like satirizing like high society and, you know, wealth that's just beyond imagination and beyond so much so that it's almost grotesque. I thought other films did it better. I didn't expect it to have such like a Jordan Peele vibe to it.
Yeah, there was definitely some Jordan Peele influences in it. I think the main problem I had, you know, you do have to suspend your disbelief a little bit in any movie.
Oh, so much, yeah.
But this one had a little more of a burden on it because you have to, You have to believe the movie when it says that these other chefs and staff have kind of bought in on this guy's cult and they're willing to destroy their lives and literally die for him.
That part I get. The guests, like at the end, the guests buying into his cult, that was more bizarre to me.
Well, it felt like the majority of the guests who died in the dining room during the fire, they had kind of just resigned themselves to their fate. But the one guy that whose motivations I did not understand was Nicholas Holt's character. Because
what do you mean? I thought he was he played it really well because I hated him too.
Well, I mean, yeah, you absolutely hate him, but the problem I had was he's the guy who is the nerdiest one in the group about the food, and he wants to be like Ralph Fiennes' character. He wants to be a cook himself, but he doesn't really understand it. And he was willing, you know, even though he was told months in advance of the plot, he knew that they were all going to die there. I just didn't buy that there would be a person out there who would be slavishly a fan of anyone to be willing to die for them in that way.
I don't know, man. I think there are.
When they're publicly humiliated by their idol to then go and kill themselves.
That part was bizarre. I agree with you there. I thought the part where Ralph Fiennes whispers something in his ear and then it leads to him hanging himself, that was bizarre. I thought that was bad writing in the fact that they didn't know quite what to do with him. So they just decided to just, hey, maybe this character offs himself. Didn't buy it. One of my major gripes is the cheeseburger Ralph Fiennes makes at the end.
Okay.
and I kind of knew, like, it kind of goes back to my theory too, because like I hate haute cuisine, like the high end stuff, like the little big plate, little bite shit.
Yeah.
I can't stand it. So it's kind of like those things where like you go to an Italian restaurant, they can't make a good bolognese or meat sauce, then it's no good. Or, you know, French chef can't make a good omelet, then it's no good. My gripe with the cheeseburger is, what kind of monster puts a sesame bun on a cheeseburger like that? To me, a good cheeseburger has to have no sesame seeds on the bun.
Wow.
When I saw so many sesame seeds on a cheeseburger like that, I was just immediately turned off. I was like, no. But
Brioche for you or die? That's the only way to do it?
No, not brioche. I don't like brioche on a burger either. Just a good old regular bun.
No, okay, like a potato bun.
Doesn't have to be potato, but doesn't have to be brioche. It shouldn't have sesame seeds on there.
Okay.
Certain burgers I'll give an exception for, like a Big Mac, I think, has sesame seeds on it. And that's a pretty decent burger, but that's not a cheeseburger. Cheeseburger to me has no sesame seeds. But anyway, I just thought that Anya Taylor-Joy's character was far too predictable. She was definitely a proxy for the audience.
Yeah, and she has the final girl kind of aspect to the character's writing.
And then once she saw the picture of Ralph Fiennes being a line cook at like a diner of some kind, like that was the moment where you knew she was really gonna do the Anton Ego thing in Ratatouille, where he finally remembers the joy of just eating or making food.
And I thought that there was going to be at least a few more kind of steps before she found her way off of the island.
Yeah.
You know, like that it felt too easy for her to just sort of, you know, buy her reprieve or whatever with that act and not some sort of outsmarting of him.
Yeah. And again, like to your point, the juxtaposition between this really fancy $1,500 a head restaurant versus the way people get killed, like a knife to the throat, getting blown up, getting chased through the field. It didn't seem as elegant as the food. And I thought that was a bad juxtaposition. I thought, as you said, the plot and the deaths would be a little more sophisticated.
Yeah.
Like we had one scene where this guy blows his brains out. And okay, you get the shock factor, but I didn't understand the point really. Was it really to just shock the guests into thinking that they're in this like crazy show? I thought it was more scary the fact that these people were ingesting food that was meant to insult them and they had zero clue. Yeah. I thought that was the best part of the film.
Yeah. So, I mean, overall, it's a kind of...
And also one final note. It's like 90 minutes or 100 minutes. It felt longer than that.
It did feel a bit longer, yeah.
Partly due to the tension, but also partly because I found some parts really unbearable to watch. And not because it was bad, but because the guests were annoying as hell.
Yeah, especially those finance bros were really annoying.
The finance bros, I kind of see it. John Leguizamo was awful. Like his character, not his performance. Nicholas Hoult is everything I hate about foodies. Yeah. In fact, I hate the term foodies for that reason.
Yeah.
I thought the fact that Anya Taylor-Joy was supposed to be playing this escort who moves a previous client at this dinner as some sort of like big coincidence. I don't know if that was neatly tied up. I don't know if that was necessary.
You think it could have been... She
could have just been like a girlfriend, an ex-girlfriend that he decided to take on a whim.
Right.
Because the crux is that she's upset about, one, the food, and two, that he knowingly brought her... even though he had been warned that everyone would die.
Yeah. And that they seemed to change how she felt about that as the movie went on. At first, it seemed like she felt as though he had, like, you know, been sleeping around. But then it morphed into something else. And so they changed her how she was reacting to the situation to sort of suit the film. But Hong Chau is in there as a creepy host who...
She's better in the whale than she is here.
Oh, okay.
And her role in the whale is bigger.
Sure, too. That makes sense.
But I think she was really great. Ralph Fiennes was good. I don't see a best actor in there, though.
No. This is more like just, you know, entertainment of the week kind of thing.
yeah, agreed.
So Babylon, I think we might have brought it up very briefly at the end of one of the recent episodes, but you know, we were talking about how Damien Chazelle, famously of Whiplash and La La Land and First Man, had a new movie coming out. Yep. And you know, it was very much a like, just based on the premise alone, seemed like it was playing to all his usual obsessions. Yep. He was, you know, you've got a film that's set that's like adoring picture of Hollywood at a certain time in its history, an ode to jazz, an ode to love, and all of these things that, you know, he's often depicted in his films that he seems to be quite taken with as subject matter. And here he is with Babylon, this movie set in 1920s, 1930s Hollywood, jazz age.
Of course.
With a... broadly fictionalized, but, you know, drawing from real sources kind of story about various people making their way in Hollywood at various points in their career and how the excesses of the time and the excesses of the movie industry all wear them down and send them off in multiple directions and in many cases ruin their lives.
Good morning.
Good job for you.
I'll do anything.
That's the cocksucker they sent to screw us.
Yeah! This bitch is stealing the scene right from under me. She's icing her nipples so they perk up through her dress.
I ain't icing my nipples. This is natural.
What do you say we come in for my close-up now?
But they still feel drawn to, like, performing or to having a backstage role and making movies happen because movies are just that good. And it is, I think Roger Ebert once said, you could describe it as too much of a muchness.
Okay.
Just too goddamn much. There's too much happening. It's an ensemble cast for one thing. So we're following multiple characters. There's no one person who's really the hero as far as the movie is concerned. And we're just like flitting around, speeding through time, being dumped into these 10 or 15 minute party scenes with all kinds of, you know, crazy orgies happening around the camera, elephants, dancers, booze, drugs. You know, it's all in free.
This sounds awesome, Rob, actually.
It is awesome until you realize, it's 3 hours and 15 minutes of that.
Oh my goodness. So it's funny that you should say that because Wolf of Wall Street is kind of like that. There's like a bunch of different threads, but it's so much better. Well done.
Well, because that is focused around a particular guy and his route through all of the ups and downs of his career and the scams that he pulled and stuff like that. This is a little bit too blown apart.
Mm.
You've got Margot Robbie as Nellie LeRoy, who's kind of like an amalgam of various other silent stars of the period, who, you know, rose up to a career in the silence from nothing. You know, she just showed, she was thrown onto set one day because she looked pretty enough to fill in for a girl who had overdosed. And she, you know, her natural talent just carried her the rest of the way. And then you've got Brad Pitt as a, you know, classic Errol Flynn type silent action slash romance star who is kind of reaching a crest in his career. And the advent of sound in movies has an impact on him, which fortunately we've seen that before in Singin' in the Rain and The Artist and a number of other movies about movies. And then you've got this character. He's a Mexican immigrant named Manny Torres, who starts out as an assistant to one of the studio executives, played by Jeff Garlin, who is kind of like the fixer. He's running around trying to make the studio executives' parties go smoothly, and he, you know, he can get anything, he can help anyone, he can, you throw him into a situation and he'll get it straightened out for you. And so he slowly works his way into a position of more influence in Hollywood, starts working for Brad Pitt's character for a little while, and then he turns that into an opportunity to be a director of sound for a movie studio. And he and Nelly LeRoy, the Margot Robbie character, are intertwined because they met at a party in the beginning of the film, and they become kind of friends, but also, you know, he's attracted to her, but she doesn't really see it. And, you know, they're like ships passing in the night a little bit. And it has that kind of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood type thing where, you know, again, starring Margot Robbie and Brad Pitt, but in that, we're thrown into all these situations over time, but there's no real sense of plot. Like, you don't know what the characters are really after other than fame and fortune.
You think Damien Chazelle bit off more than he could chew?
No, I think he could manage the size of the production. I think I don't think he was like overwhelmed, but I think the problem is just the size of the story he's trying to tell. I think it would have been a lot better if he had picked one character and then had other supporting characters around it. In this, it doesn't really feel like there's one person who we should really care about. We're supposed to care about all these different people equally, and we don't get enough of their individual stories to really get to know them in a way that matters. And then you just throw in on top all of the, like, you know, the big long sequences with the jazz trumpeter, who's another story we're following, who has to deal with racism in the movie business. And, you know, all of these long sequences of him playing his trumpet, and the camera zooms in on the bell of his trumpet, and, you know, and it's just like, yeah, jazz. And it's like Damien Chazelle just, you know, getting really, you know, the Whiplash era Damien Chazelle comes back you're just like, okay, we get it. Yes, jazz is good. Yes, all right. We don't have to linger on it, you know?
It just seems like his productions get bigger and bigger. And that's always harder to do, right? Because there's so many more things you have to keep in mind of.
Yeah. And you also have to, like, you wonder sometimes whether certain sequences were made big just for shock value.
Yeah,
like,
fair enough.
You know, this big party in the first 15 minutes where we're introduced to most of the characters, and there's an elephant running around, and the camera gets covered in elephant poop at one point, and you know, the just the sheer number of extras and the amount of, like, stimulation, the visual stimulation is just, it's kind of off the charts, and you're like, oh, okay.
Again, sounds like Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah. Probably my favorite scene was actually kind of, it was in the first hour. It was the making of this silent medieval war picture that the Brad Pitt character is starring in. And it's just an absolute nightmare of like extras who had been hired off of the street, put in a costume and just told to, like, run at each other with spears. And Spike Jones is in there playing this German director who's just he's driving around on a car with a camera screaming, "Schnell, schnell, schnell, motherfuckers." And the extras are accidentally, like, spearing each other and, like, goring each other. And there's just explosions going off. And the writers are in a tent getting drunk with Brad Pitt. And it just, you know, the quick cutting, and you're like, blah, blah, blah. That was where I think the movie was at its best, where it kind of used that energy well. But in other places, it just felt like we were being hammered over the head a little bit.
Yeah, I think it, for those kind of sprawling films, especially the really long ones, it takes a special kind of director to pull it all together. And sometimes it doesn't, but it just thematically works. So, like, Robert Altman's Nashville, that's like a 4-hour film. And it just like goes in all sorts of directions, but it kind of works. Tokyo Story is like 4 hours, but it kind of works. So this is really interesting. I talked to a friend of mine who also watched the movie. He said, watch the first 90 minutes, the second 90 minutes, forget about it. Like, it's not worth your time.
I could kind of see that. Yeah. Like, you would get the opening party scene, which is fun and of its own, you know, it establishes the characters. You get that bit that I was just telling you about with the making of the silent medieval thing. And yeah, you could probably drop off like 90 or 120 minutes and be fine.
All right. So needless to say, this is not getting anything.
No, this is a movie kind of like Mank in the sense that it might get some technical nominations, but it's not going to really win anything, I don't think, because it's just made for movie nerds, you know, and that's fine. Right. You know, it's just a niche audience. And I don't think the Academy is going to be too interested in it.
On a scale of 0 to 10, how is Tobey Maguire's cameo?
Actually, not as good as I hoped. I would put him at like a...
I've heard the same refrain from a lot of people.
I put him at like a 4 out of 10, probably.
What? That's really low.
Yeah. Because he's there, and it's clear that he has an idea for what the character should be, but the character never does anything really like creepy or over the top that it's kind of hinted at he's capable of. He takes... Mm-hmm. He takes Manny, one of the characters, down into this horrible den of like depravity that's hosting some kind of party. So he's the means for the care for the audience to see what's happening at this, in this crazy underground rave place. But other than that, you're like, oh, okay, that's the only point of this character is to bring us in here, and then nothing else happens.
All right. Speaking of bringing people to places, we go to far off Ireland.
Yeah, Ireland in the 1920s. We're kind of in the same time period, just very, very different place.
Yeah, like worlds apart. Yeah. Literally worlds apart.
Yeah.
Banshees of Inisherin.
Now, if I've done something to you, just tell me what I've done to you.
When you didn't do anything to me, I just don't like you no more.
You didn't like me yesterday.
Why does he not want to be friends with you no more? Why is he 12?
What the hell's going on with you, me feckin' brother?
He's dull, Siobhan.
But he's always been dull.
The other night, 2 hours you spent talking to me about the things you found in your little donkey shite that day.
Well, it wasn't me little donkey shite. It was me pony shite, which shows how much you were listening.
I think you probably liked this more than I did, although I can see the performances getting nominated, but nothing else.
The screenplay, probably.
Oh, okay, yes, screenplay. But Brendan Gleeson, Colin Farrell, Kerry Condon, Barry Keoghan, the four main actors, brilliant. Really great stuff.
Yes.
I actually think Barry Keoghan's performance is the one I enjoyed the most. I think I've seen better from Colin Farrell, but it's the two supporting characters that I like the most in this one.
Yeah, and I mean, it might be that... The overall like thrust of the story isn't all that impactful because it's just about it's just about these characters' relationships and how they feel about their legacies living on this island, which doesn't really connect with like a broader kind of theme other than like, you know, I don't know, be nice to your friends.
Like it's kind of set in the backdrop of the Civil War.
Yes,
right?
So it's supposed to and echo about that.
Yeah, and how dumb this entire conflict is. And maybe it's because we've seen In Bruges, and maybe it's because we've seen Seven Psychopaths. But I was waiting for this like big violent bang moment that we never got. I mean, the most violent thing we ever saw was hilariously Brendan Gleeson throwing thumbs at Colin Farrell's door.
Yeah.
There was no big blow up. I found the character development sometimes lacking. I actually found Barry Keoghan and Kerry Condon characters again having more development. Colin Farrell and Brendan Gleeson are two guys who just are set in their ways and refuse to budge, and so I didn't find that relationship particularly, you know, compelling, but the way their conflict affects other people is probably the best part of that movie.
Yeah, because the town, I think we talked about this during our TIFF wrap-up, but the way the town is initially on Colin Farrell's side, but then they slowly shift to be on Brendan Gleeson's side because they see that their fight is actually having a bigger impact on the town than it seems. And they're just like, we just want this to be over. Like, why can't you guys just, you know, leave each other alone?
Yeah. And the fact that, you know, it leads to people dying or leaving their little town altogether. Although there is something to be said about, you know, these little hilarious stories set in these little towns that, you know, conflicts that you probably won't get in many other movies.
So, like, you know, that I think that's where I really connected with it, because I, you know, growing up on the East Coast of Canada, you know, there's a lot of common, there's a lot in common between those two parts of the world, and shared folklore and shared accents to a certain aspect. So,
yeah, but you have all your fingers still.
I do. Yeah. I never got into a fight that ended up me chopping my own fingers off. But so maybe I connected with it a little bit more because of that shared folklore. But and, you know, yeah, it feels like the kind of thing that would happen in the East Coast of Canada, where some two guys would be
would
be in some rural place. And that would be the literally the most important thing to them in their entire lives would be their friendship falling apart. So,
yeah, that one grudge that is held forever.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of like the linchpin of their entire life purpose.
Yeah. Because they don't have a whole lot else going on. But
yeah. I love the line where I think it's Colin Farrell's character who says, like, we're boring people in the most boring town in Ireland. What do you expect?
Yeah. Yeah. It's and that's where, like, Brendan Gleeson's character becomes or is revealed to be a little bit more of, like, you know, he's pretentious despite not having a particularly good.
Oh, he's a prick. Come on. He's the prick in that conflict, don't you think?
No, I know, but I'm saying, like, he's revealed to be, like, it's unclear why he thinks so highly of himself, because he's a musician, you know. He desperately wants to leave a legacy. He's terrified of being forgotten when he dies, but, you know, he's not Mozart, he's not Beethoven, he hasn't contributed or been, you know, lauded the way those people are. So
he wants to be a bigger fish in a bigger pond, that's all. And Colin Farrell's like, what's wrong with our pond? That's basically the gist of the story.
So yeah, it's a cute story. It's melancholy, obviously. It has a much darker third act than I think some of the marketing suggested, but
yeah, but again, not as violent or abrupt as the other two films, right?
No, exactly. So yeah, very different from some of McDonough's previous work in that respect. But you know, if it's your thing, I recommend it. If you like Martin McDonagh's work, you're not going to go wrong, I don't think.
Well, it's been, like, speaking on that note, like, it's been a pretty banner year for A24, don't you think?
Yeah, they've been doing some pretty good deal making, like, when it comes to picking these titles up.
Like, Everything Everywhere All at Once, After Sun, The Whale, this one, After Yang, is a 2022 film, I think. Yeah. They classified it. That's an A24 film. Men, A24. A lot of good stuff from them today. This year.
We'll see if it yields them the awards in a few months' time. There's still a bit of for your consideration campaigns to go. We'll see, you know, if some other things end up challenging Everything Everywhere All at Once. But I'd be down with that movie winning. You know,
I don't know if I am, but it's just my pick, I think.
Okay. Well, that about does it for this episode, though. So come on back next time, and we will be choosing some definitive top tens, I think.
Okay.
We won't just talk about the things we've seen in the past month or two, but we'll be flashing all the way back to January of 2022. Gathering everything together. As you already heard, RRR is going to be on there because I'm repping that movie. I loved it a lot.
I will do my best and try and swallow the bitter pill and go catch The Fablemans if I can. So, the things we do for this podcast.
The things we do for you, dear listener. But until then, my name is Robert Snow in Toronto.
And my name is Jason Chen in Vancouver. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.
The Extra Buttery Podcast is written, recorded, and produced by Jason Chen and Robert Snow. Thank you for listening, and don't forget to rate and subscribe on the podcast platform of your choice. And remember, popcorn is always better with extra butter.